Sandy just apologized for breaking my anonymity. It's my privilege to do that, and I do. My name is Harriet. I am an alcoholic. And delighted to be here. I thank the committee for inviting me. I'm one of those old, familiar faces. I did miss last year. I was here the first 2 years, the third year, and back again this year at your invitation. And it was a privilege to be here those first years at your invitation to get this thing started 5 years ago. And I remember when Dave called and said, we're not sure we're going to be able to pay all the expenses, and we don't know how it's going to go. It seems to have gone quite well to be in its fifth year, and I'm very happy for the committee. They've worked hard. And I thank Sandy and Carol. They've been, Sandy is my hostess, and Carol has supplied the corsage. And wasn't it nice to see these pretty ladies all dressed up and looking like ladies coming up here to the podium? And one lady with, sounded like 4 or 5 weeks of sobriety, reading the traditions. I'm one who believes that if it were not for the traditions, AA wouldn't be here for her. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has these traditions which we need to follow. They were given to us as guidelines to be able to work together, to live together. When Bill and Dr. Bob, our co-founders, realized that they were mortal and would not be with us forever, they said, we give you the fellowship. It's yours. And here are the traditions which will help keep us together in unity for all time. And because of that, we're gathered here tonight to stay sober together. My sobriety date is January 14th, 1956, which is 36 years ago and a few weeks, months. And I was born in Pennsylvania. I'm an only child. I was a happy child. I had a lovely home. My parents loved me very much, and I loved them. I don't think it was dysfunctional in any way at all. My parents argued occasionally, like any normal man and woman trying to get along in young marriage and a small child. My father was not well educated. He had, I don't believe he was finished eighth grade. And as a result, he wanted me to have the best education he could find for me. My mother was very well educated for a woman of her day, and had gone away to college and was a music teacher, taught piano. And as a result of her education, she too wanted me to have the best education that they could find for me. And so they chose my schools, and they chose my friends, and they directed my life. They managed my life for me because they wanted a perfect little girl. And they sent me to dancing school to learn how to function in social affairs. And affairs, believe me, I had those too. And that was dysfunctional. The most of them were, anyway. And so I learned my manners, and I learned to wear the white gloves and the black patent leather shoes and the earrings that I hated and the little dab of perfume behind my ear. And so I was learning to be a little lady. And when I went off to college, my parents would tell me which boys they liked for me to bring home the second time and which ones not to bring home a second time. We lived out in the country in those days, at least it seemed like out in the country way back then, and a large house. It was a remodeled farmhouse. My father did very well in business, and well, we were never rich, rich, rich. We were never poor. We were very comfortable, and I was privileged to have many good things. My own car before I had a driver's license to drive it, parties at other people's homes and at our home, and the orchestras, and all the good things that are part of the country had. But when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and my parents had been playing cards and one evening, and about midnight they decided they had enough cards and they were going to go downtown to Ray Hoddle's for lobster and clams, steamed clams. And, of course, they couldn't leave me alone, so I went too. And I'm sure this had happened many times, but this is the one I remember. because it was the night that I was eating my steamed clams at midnight with the grown-ups, and someone said, "Here, drink this. It will help your indigestion." And I did not know I had indigestion. But being an obedient child, I drank what they told me to drink, and it was bitter. It tasted funny. It left a little white mark around my lip, and it went down, and I said, "Oh, isn't that good?" And I looked around, and all of a sudden, I was just as grown up as anybody. And I could handle my lobster better. And I could eat more steamed clams. And I've never forgotten that feeling as that beer or ale or whatever it was entered my system and went to my head, and it just blossomed. When I was about 15, I had the measles. And I was going off to college that fall. And so when the doctor prescribed a little port wine to help me get my strength back, my father didn't know what a little port wine was, and he brought a bottle, and he put it beside my bed. And again, they went off someplace, and when they came back, I had drunk up the whole bottle. I had vomited, I was sick, and I had passed out, and I was miserable, and I came to, and I said, "Oh, wasn't that good?" I always liked the effect. And I've never forgotten either one of those two incidents and how I've reacted and how I felt. When I went to college, it was at that time under the Methodist Church, and there was, if there was any drinking at all, I didn't know about it until my junior, senior year, which we were coming toward the end of Prohibition times. And people were beginning to get very conscious of the fact that Prohibition was going to be repealed. There may be some of you here in this room that don't even know what Prohibition was. It was the law of the land that liquor would not be sold legally. And that's when bootlegging came in. And so when the act was about to be come to an end, we were all beginning to talk about the alcohol that we'd be able to get in one form or another. And, of course, my little crowd was the one that wanted to have some. And every once in a while, a bottle would be produced. And it never could have been much more than a pint, I don't think. None of us had any money back in those days. It was Depression times, the big Depression, the really big one. And if we had one, it was small, and usually there were two couples, and we'd take that bottle out to the car at intermission time, and we'd pass the bottle around, and nobody could get much. But I would start to giggle as soon as the top came off. I just knew. I anticipated. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you told me that this disease was physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual, I understood immediately what that mental was. My mental, I was always obsessed by the thought of alcohol. From the time I had that first beer at Ray Hoddle's at 9 years old, the mental obsession had started back then. And the physical compulsion began to come every time alcohol was mentioned. I want some. Can I get some? Where is it? Where is it? And the spiritual degradation came later. I suppose it started even then, but when it came fast. But that mental compulsion was with me from that first drink. It was just like, some people say that they drank too much, too often, and too long, and became alcoholic. They crossed over an invisible line and became an alcoholic. For me, I don't understand that. I was alcoholic from the beginning. I was alcoholic from the moment I had that first drink, and the obsession started as a 9-year-old kid. And my drinking was too much, too often, and too long, because I didn't know any other way to drink. And as time went along, and people would comment on my drinking, and they'd say, "Why do you drink like that? Don't drink like that. Why don't you drink socially? Why don't you drink like I do?" I didn't know what they were talking about. I drank like I drank because that's the only way I knew how. I can remember, after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remembered during those last 2 years of college, when we began having these little bottles passed around, that we'd go back into the dance, and I would be dancing perhaps with Dave, and all of a sudden, I'm dancing with Tom. And I thought, well, what happened? And I didn't know until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous many years later that I'd had a little blackout. Just from that little bit of booze that we had at intermission time. And as I said, for four people and probably a pint, you know how much I got, a thimbleful. But it was enough for me, this alcoholic. It was enough. And you don't have to have blackouts to be an alcoholic, but it helps. There's a symptom. It's one of the symptoms. It sure is. And a little later on, when I went back home from college, from Washington, D.C., I went back to Pennsylvania, and I started running with an older crowd. Oh, they were really old. They had graduated from Lafayette and Lehigh and Washington and Lee, and they were, oh, you know, 24 years old, 25. I was 19 and very immature. We alcoholics are supposed to stop growing emotionally when we're 13 or 14 or 15. I'm not sure I made it to that age. I can't believe I was so immature at various stages of my life as I look back on it now. And I hope I don't look back on it 10 years from now and say, gee, she wasn't doing so good in 1992. But the immaturity showed, because I really thought that this gang of 24 and 25-year-olds were the epitome of high society. And I went pub crawling with them. And they found out that I could hold my booze. And they said, don't worry, Harry, it'll drive us home. I was the kid with the hollow leg when I was 19. And we used to drive up to Scranton to dance at the Hotel Casey on Saturday night. And everybody would be getting drunk, and they'd say, well, who's going to drive home? Harriet will drive us home. She can hold her booze. She can hold her liquor. And I was the one to drive them home. And yet, not a year or so later, I was the fallen down drunk one. We had to find another designated driver, even before there were designated drivers. But that's another symptom. You don't have to have these, but it's one of them. And I had them. And it was around that time my father, who loved me so much, and he would brag on me, and he'd say, my girl can drink like a man. And he meant it as a compliment. And I thought to myself, I cringed, because I knew there was something wrong with my drinking. And here I am all dolled up with my earrings and my high heels and my perfume behind my ears and my white gloves. My little girl can drink like a man. And it just didn't make sense to me, but I knew that there was something related there. Alcoholism was right there in my family, and I was it. I was it. I graduated from college, and the day I was graduated, my father told me we were broke, and he'd had a terrible time financially getting me through college. He'd been most generous with me, and with all of everything. Well, we were all broke back in those days. This was 1936. And so he said, you better get a real job. School teaching isn't going to do it. So I got a secretarial course under my belt, and this was about the last thing my parents dictated or managed me into. They really had managed my life. I had no mind of my own. I didn't need one. You know, you got two parents who love you and want the best for you, and they tell you what to do. That's all you need. And so I went to secretarial course, and I became a very good secretary, fortunately, because I've had to earn my living ever since by doing that. So my first job when I got away from there was with the government. I became a federal government employee, and they sent me to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And my parents drove me there and ensconced me in a room in a private home. They rented out two or three rooms. And my room and my parents left and went back to Wilkes-Barre. And here I am in Philadelphia now, and I have a new manager. I got me a new manager that very first weekend. And the new manager told me exactly the same things that my parents used to tell me. Which boys to go out with the second time, where to go, what to wear, how to act, how to talk. My new manager was alcohol. And alcohol was my higher power until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol was my manager in every area of my life. It dictated my every move, my social life, everything. And so I began stopping at the pubs on the way home from work. On weekends, we would get drunk, and I found out that we were going over to New Jersey a lot because of the blue laws of Pennsylvania. And we could drink later on Saturday nights, and we could drink on Sundays in New Jersey over in Camden. And it occurred to me there was something a little wrong with my drinking, and I'd better take up a... I was 20, 21, 22 years old, and I thought, I better take up a hobby. I'm drinking too much. And I began to change my drinks. I used to try to change from drinking at certain times of the day. I tried different going out with different crowds of people. But I did go to the dime store and bought myself a hobby, and my hobby was painting by the numbers. And I would sit in this room and paint by the numbers and drink beer. And I kept my beer right there on the window ledge. I had a bay window overlooking the roof of the front porch. And one evening I reached over for the beer, and it rolled out the window. And it had been snowing, and the roof was snow and ice, and I slid right down there after it. I was only 21. I was thin. I was agile, athletic. And I went out, and I went down in the gutter and retrieved my beer, and I turned around to claw my way back up through the snow and the ice, and it occurred to me that this was not social drinking. There were other beers there. I didn't have to have that particular bottle. And I never bought small ones. They were big ones. And the name of the beer was Gretz, G-R-E-T-Z. It was important to me. I knew Carl Gretz, and I thought it only right I drink his beer. About that time, it was announced that the school, the quartermaster school that I was working for, was picking up, moving physically to Petersburg, Virginia, to Camp Lee, which is now Fort Lee. And they invited some of the employees to move permanently down to Petersburg, and they asked some of us ladies if we would like to go, and we said yes. And a half a dozen of us did. And we had a wonderful time in 1941. The officers' clubs were open to us. We swam, we danced, and the young officers were very good to us. And we had a lot of fun. But I was the one that embarrassed people. I was the one that got drunk. I was the one that would get sick. I was the one that had to be taken home or parked in somebody's car. I was the one who couldn't show up for work. And I was beginning to be reprimanded for my poor sloppy workmanship. And December the 7th, 1941, came home. It was a Sunday afternoon. We were playing cards, and the phone rang and said, "Have you heard the news? We're at war. Pearl Harbor has been bombed by the Japanese." I thought it was a movie. I really thought, when the book says to me, selfishness, self-centeredness, we think is the root of all our problems. I understood the selfishness, and I thought, my goodness, I was brought up to be unselfish. I was brought up to share with my friends, to share my material things. And I don't understand it. I was never selfish. But when I began to stay sober for a while and I look back on my life, I was so self-centered. And the selfishness was nothing to do with material things. I couldn't share with me. I couldn't share of me. I couldn't give of myself. And that day of Pearl Harbor, I remember all I could think of was me and my personal pleasures. All I could think of was now the boys were going to have to go to war, and who would I go dancing with? You know, and why were they putting on this show just for me? It wasn't real to me. Life was not real. It was just for my personal entertainment. I didn't know that at the time. But as I look back on it now, I just realized that was what it was for. And I think being an only child had a lot to do with it, and being the subject of parents' doting and love. And so it seemed natural. A lot of us in AA seem to be only children. I don't recall anything in any of our surveys having shown that, but I've heard an awful lot of speakers say that they're an only child, or perhaps a favored child, the oldest one, the youngest one, or the in some way the most standout one. In any event, this World War II came along, and pretty soon I realized that my drinking problem, or my problem of not being able to get to work, was going to be an even greater problem, and I said, well, I better get out of here. I began to change my attitude toward my work, and I said, I got to maybe get into one of the services. The Women's Army Corps was forming, and I didn't care for their uniforms. And this was a very patriotic deal, you see. And if I was going to do it, I'd better get a good-looking uniform. So I tossed out the idea of joining the WACS, and I looked over the other uniforms, and I decided that the Marines, the Lady Marines in World War II, wore a snazzy outfit. It was drab. It was olive drab, and red ascot tie. I could have gone to the dime store and bought a red tie. But the cap had a red silk cord around the front, and it was my kind of thing. I was a brunette, and I was thin, and I was pretty, and it was okay. I thought that was great. So I decided to join the Marine Corps. And the day that I couldn't get to work and the day that I knew that I was going to be demoted, because they'd already threatened me with that. And I made my way to Richmond, Virginia. And by the time I got there, I was so sick and I needed to drink badly. And they had me signing an awful lot of papers. And I was so busy concentrating on keeping my hand steady. Have you ever tried to sign your name in front of somebody and the pen just won't go where you want it to go? It goes off here someplace. Especially when you're doing a bad check. And they're asking me questions, and I heard them say, to go to officer training school. I said, no, I don't want to be an officer. I said, oh, yes, look at this wonderful education. You'll make us a fine leader. What is this vice doing up here? Gosh, somebody get their head in there and be bad. I said, no, I just don't want to be an officer. I said, well, you'll make us a fine leader. They didn't know what kind of leader they were getting. But in any event, by the time we got all through, and I'm trying not to show how sick I am, I'm putting on that act that you and I all know so well. You know, the smile and looking good on the outside and dying on the inside. And that's what was happening to me right then and there. And we got all through, and the man shook my hand, and he swore me in, and then he shook my hand, and he said to me, welcome to the United States Navy. And I backed up a moment, and I said, sir, I came here to join the Marine Corps. And he said, I'm sorry, honey, you got off the elevator on the wrong floor, and you are in the Navy now. Years later, 1956, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to ride another elevator. In 1956, my first few days and weeks of sobriety, the intergroup office in Miami, where I live today, was in a building downtown, an office building called the Pacific Building. And I would get in that elevator and go up to, I think, the fifth floor to the intergroup office. And I would sit with Paul, our intergroup secretary, and just be comfortable with the four walls around me and the outside world out there. And Paul would answer the phone or be answering some letters or perhaps talking to another AA member. And I felt safe and secure within this intergroup office. And then I would leave there and walk a few more blocks to the Inanna Club, which is no longer in existence, but it was at across the Flagler Street Bridge at Northwest South River Drive. And that was a mouthful for a newly sober drunk. I couldn't understand Northwest South River Drive. That was just too many Northwests for me. But I knew how to get there. And the Pacific Building was very important to me because Paul, every time I would leave there, and without fail, he would say, don't worry, Harriet, the man upstairs is going to take care of you. Now, I had never heard that expression in my life. And I firmly believed Paul when he told me every day that there was a man on the sixth floor of the Pacific Building who was taking care of me. And to me, it was like, I was a big girl before I would admit that maybe there was not a Santa Claus. My mother was ashamed of me because I believed in Santa Claus so long, and I'm not sure about it today yet. I also believed for a long time in the Easter Bunny. And I believed Paul Richards when he told me there was a man upstairs that would take care of me, and I believed him with all my heart. And I believe the old-timers in AA who have been sober, and there are quite a few right here in this room tonight, I believe me when they tell me that I can keep on staying sober if I keep on doing what I've been doing for these 36 years. And for the young lady with a month's sobriety, if she keeps on reading some traditions and coming to these meetings and looking as pretty as she does tonight and puts this program into her life, she's going to stay sober. And staying sober is just the beginning. It's learning how to live and facing life head-on, without having to ever take a drink again. That's what this program is about. It's not about drinking and giving up drinking. It's about learning how to live without alcohol. It's learning how to live as life comes to us. And I can remember the first time after I'd been sober for a while and things were not quite going my way. And I had married a fellow named Bob, and my Bob, and perhaps I'll get around to that, I don't know. But Bob never could stay sober. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, I have to get a job. And they said, no, not yet. And they said, I have to find my own apartment. And they said, no, not yet.
And I said, look at that cute fellow over there. And they said, no, not yet. But I married him. I married him. I was about 3 months sober when I married him. But he never could stay sober. And some problems arose out of that. And the first time I heard a speaker from the podium say, when life hands you a lemon, make lemonade. I may have heard that thing 100 times before, but I heard it that day. I said, darn, I'm going to make lemonade out of this lemon. And I didn't mean just my husband. There were a few other lemons hanging around, too. But I've learned to do that pretty much since I'm sober. Life is not a continuous sweet bed of roses, you know. There are a lot of thorns. And life happens. It's the way it is. And that simple little statement has helped me over a few rough spots. So in any event, I did get into the Navy, and they assigned me to a Supply Corps depot. And they gave me a Jeep to ride around in. They assigned me several warehouses full of ammunition that had already been used, inert ammunition. There was one explosion on base while I was there. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. Thank God. They gave me 8 seamen to do the actual labor. And thank goodness they knew what they were doing, because I didn't. And they also assigned to us a forklift truck. And this forklift truck was one of my play toys, especially after 3-4 martini lunch. I would get in that warehouse and tootle around with my short skirts and the forks going up and down and the forklift going the length of the warehouse and back. And my 8 seamen thought this was the greatest entertainment they'd had since they left civilian life. Until one day, one of them, and his name was Cece, we called him Cece, he began to mutter and fuss, and I could hear him saying, what's the matter with you? Where'd you learn that kind of talk? You talk like us. That's gutter language. Where'd you learn? We don't like you anymore. And I pretended I did not hear him. And I was to do this for a long time before I came to you people, because I didn't want to hear what you were saying about me. But it confirmed what I already knew. Cece was saying exactly the way I felt inside. I knew I was changing. I knew I was no longer the sweet little lady that my mother and daddy had wanted to raise, the white gloves and the black patent leather shoes. I was turning into a drunken tramp. There's no such thing as a drunk lady. You're either a lady or you're not. You're a drunk or you're not. You know, can't be both. And I was no lady. I was a drunk. I was picked up by the shore patrol in Boston and had to be, and they'd take me home. I kid a little bit about the patriotism, but I was proud of that uniform. And I was proud of being in the Navy, and I loved my country like all of us. But it be dragged home by the shore police, and it was not nice. And so I decided in civilian life after I got out that I would go down to the Pentagon building one day, and I saw another recruiting sign. Oh, God. And this time I signed up and went to North Africa. Now, North Africa back in 1940 was not exactly the way it is today. And I don't know which is better, the way things are going. But I went to Algiers. And that's where I met my Arab. Now, my Arab was not any ordinary fellow, I'll have you know. He was a pretty big shot. He had a title. His title was Kaid. He was Kaid is like the mayor of West Palm Beach. And he was a Kaid above an oasis called Busada. And we rode our camels into the Sahara. And I thought that I would dwell forever. And you remember, I'm an only child living in the country, and my main entertainment was reading and books and radio. And we didn't have television, of course, but my fantasy took me lots of places. And I was a kid that went to a lot of movies, and Rudolph Valentino and all that kind of stuff. And so here I am in the desert with a handsome, and our camels are great, you know, and I think I'm going to dwell there forever with the oriental rugs on the floor, a little boy fanning me, and somebody feeding me grapes. I've never figured that one out, but it was part of the fantasy. And the State Department frowned on this kind of life. And they sent for me. And as we rode those camels back, my Arab, and I wish I could remember his name.
He was wearing a garment called a burnous. A burnous is a cape-like affair with a hood on it. And it was so graceful, and it just floated along, and I wanted it. And it was okay because he liked my navy raincoat. And we traded. And I wore this burnous as an evening wrap coming back aboard ship when the State Department sent me home. And I would wrap myself up in this thing and peer out, you know, like a cape, and peer out over it. And I'd lurk in corners and watch. It was very weird. I thought I was a spy. And one day I looked at this thing in some moment of truth and saw that it wasn't made of white silk. It was made of brown wool. It was full of holes. It had grit, sandy grit. And it had been wrapped around dirty goats and sheep and camels, and it literally stunk. And I don't really know whatever happened to it. I never went to jail. Should have many times. I was taken to jail one time in a paddy wagon. And to this very moment, it's the most humiliating memory of my life. I was all alone in that thing. It was black and it was slides. It's like very slidey. And they took me to jail, and in a complete blackout, I called the city manager of Alexandria, Virginia, an old friend. And the next thing I remember, I don't remember calling him, but he came and got me, and he took me home. And he put his arms around me, and he said, "Promise me you'll never drink like that again." And I promised him, and I promised my parents, and I promised my first husband, I promised lots of people that I wouldn't drink like that. But I didn't know what it meant. But I ended up in many hospitals. My first hospitalization was while I was in the Navy. I kept reporting up to sick bay, oddly enough, on Mondays. And they didn't know or didn't say what was wrong with me. They put it down as one of those funny diseases we had back then. It was called cat fever. I think everybody in World War II had cat fever, catarrh fever. And what it was a hangover. But they stuck me in Chelsea Naval Hospital. I was there 3 days. Got well. A few years later, I was stuck back in another hospital, and I stayed 5 days. As my disease of alcoholism progressed, so did my stays in the hospital. My last hospitalization was in 1955 in a veterans hospital in the locked ward, and I was there in somebody's locked ward for 4.5 months until January of 1956 before I came to you. It was during that time that I took what the big book calls a solitary self-appraisal. And I think it's that solitary self-appraisal inventory that was the push into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I'd been receiving literature about Alcoholics Anonymous off and on for some time. You know, plain envelopes addressed to me, but no return address. And you'd open it up, and there'd be something about Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that September of 1955, out popped this one. It's called A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic. It had been printed that summer in Good Housekeeping magazine. It was published in 1954 in Good Housekeeping magazine. And it was put into print by the General Service Office in 1955, and it was sent to me by an unknown admirer. And I took it out of the envelope, and I took one look at it, a letter to a woman alcoholic, addressed to the woman who is still drinking, but who may suspect that she has a problem. And I can't tell you for sure if I read all that, but I saw alcohol, an alcoholic. And I stuck it down in that great big chair I was sitting in. And I never saw that particular pamphlet again, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in January, February of 1956, and I saw this pamphlet and I recognized it. And I went over and picked it up, and I opened it up to the first page, and it says, "I am writing you this letter and putting it in a safe place where you will find it and hide it." And there's more on that page, but that's all I saw. And my reaction was, how'd they know I hit it? So you knew me, and from the first time I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that you knew me. I knew that I knew you. I knew that we were kin. I knew that we were all alcoholics, and we were all suffering from the same illness, threefold, mental, physical, and spiritual, and it's called alcoholism. And I knew it was a killer because I knew I was dying. They had come to me in the hospital and found me dying up in Jacksonville, Florida in 1955. I had called the San Marco Club there in Jacksonville. And two ladies came to call on me. And they were ladies. They were pretty white. They looked as pretty as these girls did tonight as they came up here to the podium. And they were clean and they smelled good. The first time I walked into the Anana Club, it smelled so good. I went to dirty bars, and I drank with dirty people. And, oh, God, the dirty toilets I've been in. And when I come into a clean bunch of clean AA people, and when I say clean kids, I'm talking soap and water clean. You know, I love the smell of an AA room because everybody is laughing, and everybody's got a pretty dress on, and the fellas are wearing shirts and shoes and socks and sometimes even ties. And it's just nice to see people looking good and shining eyes and sober. While I was taking that inventory in 1955, that solitary self-appraisal, I went back through my life as far as I could remember. I hadn't read the big book yet. I didn't know a thing in my world about the big book. But when I came to those words in chapter 5, we went back through our lives as far as we could remember. I said, well, that's what I did when I was still in the mental ward. And what I did then, I went back through my life as far as I could remember to figure out how a nice girl like me had ended up in the mental ward of a veterans hospital. And there I was over Christmas of 1955. And I was there because I had been associating with dirty people and dirty places. And it was just like that burnous. It was full of holes and full of grit. And it wasn't lily white. It was dark brown. And my life stunk just like that burnous did. And I knew it. And I didn't know exactly what to do, but I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the year that I was in the Christmas play. And if you've never been in the Christmas play in a booby hatch, I recommend it highly. I was King Herod. And I like red, which was only fitting because I had a red robe and I had a gold crown and I was a very fine King Herod. And the exciting thing about the whole thing was that two of our shepherds escaped on Christmas Eve. And in January, they told me I was going to be... And the wonderful thing, you know, after you're in AA for a while and you begin to hear other people's stories, and you find out that maybe somebody else that you know was in a similar spot at the very same time in Christmas in another city far away, and he was the director of his show. Our friend Clancy is here. They made him direct his Christmas pageant. Same year, wasn't it, Clancy? 56? 55. Same Christmas. They discharged me on January the 9th, and it was a Monday, and they put me on a train, and the first stop, I got a bottle. And the last thing they had said to me when they put me on the train was, don't drink like that. And I didn't know what it meant. And so I bought a bottle. And it was to be the end of the road. Because when I bought that bottle, and I do not remember buying it, I do not remember that. What I do remember is standing in front of a mirror in the ladies' room and taking a drink out of that bottle and watching myself change. And the bottle changed. The bottle got bigger and bigger and bigger. And if any of you have seen the fairly new pamphlet called The 12 Steps Illustrated, the very first page is exactly what I saw. A great big bottle and a little bitty me. And it was like Alice in Wonderland. I had shrunk. And the bottle was this big, and I knew I was beat. I was powerless over alcohol. It was going to be my birthday in just a few days. I was going to be 39 years old. And my life was a complete shambles, a mess, and I knew it. I was through. And I knew the bottle was bigger than I was, and I was beat. And as far as I'm concerned, that was the first step. And I came to believe that there was a power called Alcoholics Anonymous that could help me be brought back into normalcy. And I believe that's the second step. And I decided that I would go there and let you tell me how to run my life. I made that decision. And that's the third step. And it all happened in a flash. But I had taken the drink, the compulsion was set up, and I drank until Saturday morning, January the 14th, against my wishes. I had no defense against the first drink. I didn't know that I could pray. I didn't know how to pray. I had prayed, but it didn't mean anything. And I fought that week all the way to the bitter end. Friday, January the 13th, I was on a sleeper train on my way to Miami, Florida, trying not to drink and having to drink. Having made the decision, I was going to turn my life and will over to you people. And Friday night, January the 13th, trying to drink, crying because I couldn't get the bottle open and having to do it with my teeth. And arriving at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning on my birthday, and I said, please, God, no more. And I never took another drink. And I did not realize or know the extent of that moment until I had been sober many years. I was able to do at that moment, at about 6 o'clock, Saturday morning, January the 14th, 1956, with God's help, what I had not been able to do by myself. And that, I believe, is a spiritual experience. I did not do it by myself. I don't do it by myself today. I need spiritual help. I need your help. I cannot do it alone. I'm 36 years sober. I need you as much today, if not more, than I needed you then. I need God in my life, God as I understand him, and I do not pretend to understand. It's much too big for me, but I know, and I accept. It doesn't mean I understand, but I know. It has worked in my life. Sometime later, I looked at my birth certificate, and I had been born at just about 6 o'clock, 6:20 a.m., on January the 14th, 1900. I made my phone call from the federal, for the old FEC station in Miami, and I began going to meetings. And I hadn't been sober but a very short time when I started that rigmarole of I got to get a job, I got to get my own apartment, I got to see that fella over there. But it was not about that time that they gave me an envelope one day and said, you're going to be the treasurer. I said, okay. That's what we did things back in my day. And they gave me the envelope, and it shook a little bit, and I had $4.98. And I took it home that night and counted it. You could have given me $4,098. It was a lot of money to be trusted with a newly sober drunk. And the next week when I took it back to my meeting, I counted it again. And I had to count out a little money and buy some literature for my group, and I had to pay a little bit of rent. We paid a percentage to the club. And I was very proud of being the treasurer of my group. And pretty soon they gave me a list of names, 16 names and phone numbers, and they said, you're the program chairman. I said, okay. And I began to call those people and arrange for meetings and back and forth. And at that time, we were able to know each other in Dade County. We knew everybody. 16 groups. And, you know, we didn't have 90 meetings in 90 days back then. We couldn't have, I don't know how we could have done it. There weren't that many groups. But we had a lot of meetings, and we'd pile into cars and drive around Dade County and up here to Palm Beach to the 4th Street Clubhouse. We just did a lot of those things. And then pretty soon they said, all right, now you're the intergroup representative. I said, okay.
I went to meet, they said, well, I said, what do I do? They said, well, you go to the intergroup meeting once a month, every month for 6 months. And I'm here to tell you, if you're new in this program, and they tell you to go to intergroup, go. 36 years later, I want to tell you the truth. I never understood one word they were saying. But I did it because I was told to. I did what they told me to do. I did get a job, and I did find a fellow, and I did get married. And my husband never could stay sober. My boss died of drinking, and he died, and as a direct result of alcoholism. And the other day I said to someone, he's been dead 20 years, and they said, is it that long? I said, gee, I don't really know this. 20 years, 19, 18, close enough, you know. But he died of alcoholism, and he didn't have to. He loved this program. He was one of those people that could talk the talk. He could get up here and keep you enthralled for an hour and a half, make you want more. And he'd be drunk the next day. There are people who can't seem to walk the walk. He loved this program, and he knew all about it. He could quote it. But you got to live it. This program is for living. Don't just talk the talk. Join a group. Be part of the group. Get yourself a sponsor. Be a sponsor. A sponsor is someone who will help you with this program, help you understand words, help you understand meanings. When I grew up, a sponsor was somebody in my parents' life who sponsored my father into civic organizations and looked into their bank accounts and perhaps looked into their morals. I can remember my father saying, I don't want to do any business with that fellow. I don't like his principles. That man isn't honest. I don't want to do business with him. And my mother would say something, I'm not going to sponsor this woman. I don't think she's a good person to be in the club. Or just the other opposite. They say, no, of course I'll sponsor this person. He's a good man. He's a loyal person. And I will sponsor this woman, or I'll be sponsored into this. So my understanding of sponsorship was totally different. Here in AA, a sponsor is someone who's going to help you learn to live by using principles that perhaps you learned at home in Sunday school, or perhaps you didn't. But here we learned honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, which are the essentials. Essentials is what the book says. There aren't many essentials. The book says if we want to stay sober, we must do certain things. It doesn't say you have to do this and you have to do that. No, you don't shake a finger and say thou shalt not. But it says if you want to stay sober, here it is. And we found... They share their experience, strength, and hope with us, these founders of ours. And they share the experience that if we wanted to stay sober, there were certain things we have to do. And this is what we old-timers are trying to share today with you. If you want to stay sober, there are certain things you have to do. These 12 steps, yes, they're suggested, but you better darn well do them if you want to stay comfortable in your sobriety. The traditions, why it works. Our common welfare should come first. Our personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Our common welfare is the word welfare, you know, it's a farewell. To be well together, physically well, emotionally well, spiritually well. And this is what we're all aiming for. This is what we have in common, to recovering from alcoholism. And it depends upon the fact that we stay together. And when you determine, when you find out today that there are over 200, no, I don't want to go into that, but there are groups now all around the globe. The Russians are thinking about putting a general service office in to Moscow. We have groups in Romania, Czechoslovakia, South Africa. There's a group in Antarctica. And the name of the group is the Cracked Ice Group. There's a little pamphlet you can get from the General Service Office with the directory of all the meetings overseas, an international directory, and it's done alphabetically. And it starts out with the A's, and it's like Antarctica. And the very last one, of course, is Z, Zanzibar. And there are about 12, 15 groups in Zanzibar, and everything in between from A to Z. And people who travel a lot carry this with them. And it's just marvelous to know that we're in unity. Our common welfare is all around the world, not only around the globe east and west, but north and south. And so anywhere you go, you'll find Alcoholics Anonymous if you want to find it. I want to thank you for asking me to be a part of this weekend. I want to thank you for letting me be one of the old familiar faces. And
Thank you for letting me be here tonight to open up this wonderful meeting. Thank you.